Excellent. Episode 6 of The Eerie Listener. Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm Jay Stevens.
I'm John Lindvay. Back again.
Again.
Still can't get rid of me. I'm like a rash. That's not a nice way of putting it, I guess.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of gross. Sorry.
You're not. I let the record show you are not as gross as a rash.
Aw. Thanks, man.
No, anytime.
That was the nicest thing I heard today.
Really?
Hey, John, you're not a rash.
That's awesome. That's... We're terrible.
No, I just have a lot. I know terrible people. So how you been, man?
I don't know. There's a lot of stuff on my mind. What's on? What do you want to talk about today?
Well, I think the biggest thing that happened is the elections, right?
Yeah, sure.
You had a nice little piece on that.
Yes.
I was going to throw it to you for that. So let's start with that. The elections. Did you vote?
Yes, I voted. Did you vote?
No, I did not vote.
You didn't vote, really?
I didn't. Actually, I was busy all day. I worked all day.
Lame.
Yeah, no, it's really lame. It's really lame. But actually,
what the hell? I can't believe.
I know. And the thing is, I'm very serious about voting. Like, I'm very much a proponent of, like, hey, go vote. That is your civic duty.
Right.
But I missed it this year. So I will take all.
I'm
going to
chide you and any listener who did not vote.
Do it, please. It's terrible.
In the presidential election, I'm going to say something rash here. Like, if you don't vote that's one thing. But in these little municipal elections with so few people turn out, your vote has a lot of weight. And these offices that were elected
were important.
The president's important, but the things that affect us in our day-to-day life, the potholes, the sidewalks, the schools, all that stuff is
decided. Wait, you mean the city government pays for that? I thought Obama fixed everything.
Yeah, no. No. So all the things that really affect us, the local government, that affects us in a day-to-day life.
No, I feel terrible about it. No,
you should.
I should. Trust me. Yeah, you can lay it on.
So who would you have voted? There's someone who would you have voted for?
Well, I was going to do the write-in for Lisa Austin.
Oh, she lost by one vote, man.
Bullshit. You're lying.
No, she got spanked pretty good.
Yeah.
Well,
as a write-in, that's difficult.
Yes.
That's like one of the most difficult things to ever pull off as a write-in campaign. Has that ever succeeded?
You know, I'm sure it has somewhere. And actually, my dad was elected in a write-in campaign.
Oh.
But for a little tiny town, I grew up in a town of about 1,000, right?
So, so that really
he got
mattered.
like 10 people got together and was like, hey, let's elect Bill.
That's all it took.
Finance, on the finance committee, and they got together and they voted for him. And pretty much that was it.
Yeah.
But large election like this, I can't even think of it. And to get 1,000, 1,200 votes, maybe 1,400 votes in this district was pretty impressive. The problem when you're running a campaign, the number one hurdle to cross is name recognition.
Right.
It's really hard to get someone to go to the ballot and remember the person's name and have a positive impression of that name, even when the name's written on the ballot.
Right, because usually I feel like with most local things, because the name recognition is so hard, most people just vote party lines.
Yeah,
typically speaking.
Yeah, and there is that. We can get that in a second. There is an option for straight party voting. Which
do you think they should get rid of that?
I do.
Yeah,
I do. About 25% of all Erie County people who vote in the election selected that button. Yeah, I think that's appalling. And I think the party designation for these local elections is also appalling. Maybe for county executive or even county council it might be appropriate. But for city council, for dog catcher, for all these other races, all these other offices we fill here in the city level, I think essentially those are meaningless, right? Potholes have no party affiliation. They don't care whether Republican or Democrat fills them, right? I actually like John Evans for the city council. He was the sole Republican on this ballot for that office.
Right, and also I think in local government it's good to have dissenting opinions too. Like
right, but you're assuming that the dissenting opinion is based on party ideology. At this level,
no,
it's
I don't.
Not.
Even, I don't
it's
even
not.
Think. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think more strictly just on like ethics and practices and what they believe to be right.
Right,
yeah.
And I want to elect the most competent, smartest, most able people as possible to these positions.
Do you think
John Evans was a great financial guy and the city needed him and he was voted out. I think, I can't be sure, no one can, but I think because he was a Republican.
Right.
And that, I'm a friggin' left-wing liberal.
Right, but I mean, he's Republican, so basically he's responsible for the government shutdown, right? I'm playing the layman, if anyone can tell yet.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yes, I understand what you're saying. But yeah, no, none of that. To me, none of that really – I wouldn't trust Evans with a state school budget or know, up or down vote on food stamps. But
right.
for him to look at the numbers and think about grants or allocating money to mm-hmm. different agencies, sure, yeah, he did that well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bummer we lost him.
But overall, do you think the elections went well? Do you think it was we got a good batch this time?
Yeah,
around?
Sure. I like Jay Brennan for the county council. He is a great human being. He's also a Montana
good
Democrat.
Human beings are great. Yeah. Like they're like some of the best people. You know what I mean? When someone's a good human being,
yeah.
But we say that, and I'm not even joking. Like literally, it's very rare when you come across someone who's like just legitimately like, oh, you're just super nice. Like
yeah.
you know what I mean? Like you're just a good person.
Yeah, he's a generally good person, smart, charismatic, young guy. Hopefully, he has a bright future ahead of him. I like people who go into office. Who are ambitious, who want to expand on
that's
that.
That's what Erie needs, too.
Yeah.
That's really what Erie needs. Erie needs a lot of young blood to get in there.
Exactly. And
young professionals. Not just like young people, but yeah. like young professional-minded individuals.
So he's a great guy. Andre Horton is a huge step up from Joe Giles.
Mm.
And he's, interestingly enough, the first African-American to ever serve on the Erie County Council.
For real?
For real, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's kind of appalling, but...
It's time to, like, so we had one foot up there for so long. It's time to get
yeah.
the other foot up there
yeah,
as
we
well.
Got the president, but as Horton himself joked, right, we have a black president, but never have had a black Erie
councilman. County
yeah.
councilman, yeah. That's pretty incredible.
It is incredible. You know, let's not, I don't want to focus on his race at all. I mean, he's still there for other reasons,
yeah.
and hopefully he'll do a good job that has nothing to do with that, but it's nice to see.
Yeah. It's good to see... You know, people represented in
yeah.
a representative body of government. Yeah.
And that
you know?
Particular body, the Erie County Council, had been pretty staid. There were several guys who'd been there a long, long time. And it's good to see two of them gone this election. And
mm-hmm.
hopefully Fiore Leone will be the next.
Dun, dun, dun,
dun, dun. Anyways, term limits passed. So he's unable to serve, I think it's two consecutive terms now.
Okay.
So
that's good.
Yeah. That is good.
I think term limits are important.
Yes.
How do you feel about term limits?
In this case, I like them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see the argument against them that it does, you know, having someone who's good at the job, you know, it's not a bad thing to keep them around.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, turnover is good. That encourages new people to get involved. It pushes out
the old folks. I mean, I think it's especially important for how rapidly the economies and things like that move these days that – sometimes it's good to have – I mean, not necessarily saying, oh, wait, old ways are bad, but it's always good to make sure you have people in there that are with – have fresh perspectives on what's happening.
Yeah.
I don't mean that whether that's good or bad, but it can never really hurt to have someone who – what's the length on term limits now?
I believe the one that just passed is two consecutive terms. So,
which is a total of how many years?
I believe eight.
8 years is a long time
yeah.
to
yeah.
get some
sure.
stuff done.
Yes. No doubt. But yeah, I've also seen the flip side of term limits in state legislatures, for example,
mm.
where you get – as a result, you get a lot of these Tea Party wackos. That's an offshoot of term limits because,
yeah.
you know, again, one of the big things to get reelected is name recognition. And a lot of these guys in some rural districts or gals who had been in office a long time and had the name recognition, who knew the system, knew how to compromise, et cetera, were voted out. Or had to step down and you know, the flavor of the day was elected in. And a lot of times
yeah.
it's not necessarily the best person.
Well, unfortunately, in those situations, they can make their bed and they'll sleep in it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And
unfortunately,
that's kind of what's happening,
us to
right?
sleep in
right.
their bed
unfortunately,
as well.
They're bringing other people inside the bed as well.
They're shitting
in
all of our beds, right?
Yeah.
And forcing us to sleep in it.
Yeah.
So that's the downside of term limits. In this
but
case,
how else will
I think
people
it was
learn?
Good.
How else will people learn from their mistakes?
Yeah. You know people very well.
Not.
That's
awesome.
Yeah. So, but I think in this case it was good. The Erie County Council. And an interesting thing about it was, I think 80% of the people in the Erie County, it was for the Erie County Executive and Erie County Council. And I think the voters voted not to get their own guy out of County Council, but to get these other, like Joe Giles, like Fiore Leone, who've been sitting there for so long, who've been getting elected time after time by their district, and probably the rest of the county is recoiling in horror at the thought of these guys being there for another 20 years. You know,
right?
So
that's the good side, then.
Yeah. So I think that vote was in direct response to other districts continually, you know, putting the same people back into office.
Yeah.
So not necessarily the people who were represented by
right, right, right,
the,
right.
Yeah.
Politics. It's a weird world.
It is a weird world. It's we talked about Evans. I like Dave Brennan. I like Curtis on the council. I'm pleased with Dahl Kemper. Grossman did a fine job, but, you know, essentially this was a, you know, there was no surprises in this race. I'll give you that.
So, oh, really?
Yeah. It was pretty
much as you expected it.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's good for you. It means it proves you're smart.
Who? What? No.
Yeah, so see into the future. You saw into the future, and you're like, this is how it's going to go.
It's not me. I don't know. I'm trying to think of an applicable sports analogy. You know, it's
where in baseball can we go? What's the baseball analogy?
World Series. No, I don't know. Red Sox. The Red Sox are my team. That was very exciting. The MLB is harder, but it's like saying, I don't know, if the Red Sox played the Seawolves in a 7-game series, the Red Sox would win, right? I mean, it's not a huge stretch. That's the kind of prediction level.
But what if they gave it their heart? Like, what if they gave it their all? What if it was like a Disney movie?
The Seawolves might pull out a game.
Okay, if that's the Disney movie scenario, they pull out a game.
A game, right. Okay. They're down 3-0 and they pull out the game, and then they lose in five. You know, and then that's everyone's happy.
Yeah. And then he gets reunited with his estranged wife. Gets his son back.
The plucky 40-year-old.
Yeah.
Quad A,
yeah, the
reliever saves the game, mm-hmm, yep, in the bottom of the ninth with the big slugger at the plate, right?
Yeah, and then there's a dog that also knows some tricks. He does some cool thing.
Yeah,
credits roll.
So basically, like the Dahl Kemper Tucci race was the Red Sox playing the Seawolves, right?
Oh wow,
that's the level of. I'm no genius.
So you're telling me that lady who ran for the larger office that came down and ran for this office had more money than the other person. Interesting.
Well, it's not just the money. Her name, she has huge name recognition.
Dahl Kemper's, yeah.
Yeah. She,
don't they have, a store here, right? I forget is it something?
They do landscaping, and they also there's a jewelry store.
Yeah.
They also, they're the ones who put together Frontier Park.
Oh, yeah.
Made it what it is. So they're like
they cut down all the trees.
Yeah. They're very popular in the community, and
except for with me,
Tucci
is
a Tea Party Republican. So he's
does the Tea Party have much of a foothold in Erie?
Not in the city itself, but in the surrounding areas, I'm sure it does. Yeah.
I can't wrap my head around that stuff. Like, because I mean, I would say that I'm a Democrat as well, but I'm not like a bleeding heart anything. I'm much about like pragmatic solutions for practical problems.
You're a millennial, right?
You got to govern.
Yeah.
I think that's what I believe in. I believe in government and and having people in government then govern. And that's my biggest problem with the Tea Party is that there's a real lack of governing coming from them.
Are you winding me up? You want me to get going on this stuff? Because I will.
I mean, I don't know. How much time we got?
I mean, I'm also I call myself a left-wing liberal, but I'm a pragmatic progressive Montana Democrat, right?
Right.
And I also believe that bleeding heart liberalism really is about using government effectively as a tool, not about radical solutions. It's about making things work. It's building an egalitarian society that everyone has equal opportunity to share in the American dream, have a piece of the pie.
And the other thing is I'm a firm believer in that the government's there for the people.
Right.
To support.
Of the people, by the people.
For the people. So, that means people who are downtrodden. That means people who are doing well. It's there for everybody. And if it's not serving everybody, then that's a problem.
And one thing that sort of frightens me about popular or certainly conservative rhetoric about government, it creates a government as if it's a foreign entity outside of our control that should be destroyed.
Yeah, it's like this weird monster that no one can get a grasp of.
Yeah,
but the thing is, it's made of people.
Yes, and I think it's insidious because we have control over. If you get enough people together, you can change things. And that rhetoric discourages people from trying to change the status quo. And I think that's a big problem.
I agree. Hear, hear.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
How was your Halloween?
It was good.
Did you hand out candy?
I did.
Did you go out with the kids?
I did not. My wife did that.
Nice.
Apparently, they sprinted. We live over, just a couple blocks from Lincoln Ave, which is ground zero for Halloween.
That whole area. Because you can go there and get Snickers, man. They hand out whole Snickers bars down there.
People coming from across the city go trick-or-treating there.
And
It's safe.
When I was younger.
Well lit. There's a ton of people. Yeah. It's great candy. People do it up in that
We went down to South Shore a couple times, too, because that's where you get the real good stuff. They give you whole birthday cakes down there.
Yeah.
It's going to keep going larger and larger.
No, the South Shore is no good. The houses are too far apart.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But I'm saying not the actual proper South Shore, but the perpendicular streets.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Like the north-south running streets.
Yeah, well, Lincoln is one of those streets. Yeah. Yeah, Lincoln's perfect. Lincoln, but I don't know how Lincoln got to be like the best street in the neighborhood. But you go down there, it's like you remember Apocalypse Now? You know the scene at the bridge where everything is like they're on acid?
Are you trying to relate Lincoln a war Ave movie to
is like Apocalypse okay. Now bridge scene? All right,
it happened.
You go down there and it's like flickering lights and like sugar crazed kids running in like you know with daggers dripping with blood up and down the street.
So it's like Lord of the Flies now?
Yeah, it's like Lord of the Flies and
I've
Apocalypse
Now. I've got the conch now, Piggy.
Snickers at 5:23, Lincoln. there were. I remember one year I went out with the kids, and there were lines at the doors in Lincoln Ave to get candy. Okay, that's what we're talking about. Lines at the doors. I've never seen it. I remember when we first moved here from Montana. You know, Montana, I'd have two kids a night. You know, we'd have like a little bowl. We moved to Erie. It's Halloween night. The kids are out. Like, I get my bowl out. Within 5 minutes,
you're
it's
empty.
Gone.
Yeah.
And I have none left. So I had to run out to the store and buy, like, six of those huge bags
of
candy.
What a bleeding heart. Look at you. You're so
and pass
precious.
Them all out. I had nothing left over.
My wife and I, whenever we hand out candy, we always underestimate. And the other thing is, too, when you start getting out candy, you're all liberal. You're gracious. You're like, oh, come here. Your costume's great. Here's a mittenful. And then at the end, you're like, you get one.
Yeah.
You get a piece of candy.
I love when the pillowcase kids come around at the end of the night. The teenagers with no costumes with a pillowcase.
Hey, what's up?
What's up? Give me a candy. What do you got?
It's Halloween. You're supposed to give me candy.
And they go through your bowl, you know, looking for
you
something.
Let them go through your – I don't – see, that's your first mistake. You don't let them go through the bowl.
But they only get there like at 7:30. All that's left of those nasty, chewy, like
candy
licorice
corn.
Candy things.
Here's a fun fact. Do you know how much candy corn they make in a year?
No.
For Halloween. It's like some absurd amount. I think it's like something like 300 million pieces of candy corn.
Really?
Like probably more than that. Guess how much of it gets thrown away?
70%.
All of it, because it's garbage. Don't eat that shit. It's terrible. It's not good for you.
Would you make organic? I mean, what would you do? Like, would you start a business making organic candy corn?
No, I would start a business of destroying candy corn factories to get it off. That stuff does
what's
not deserve
candy?
To exist.
What's your candy?
To give out?
Yeah, we know that you like to get.
Oh, my favorite, Twizzlers. That's my jam.
Twizzlers. Huh?
I'm all about Twizzlers.
I'm not a chewy candy guy.
Well, yeah. What's your beef?
I like. What do I dislike about it?
Yeah, it gets stuck in my teeth.
Stuff that gets stuck in my teeth, I hate. Like popcorn, I can't stand. Popcorn.
Yeah, I have this love-hate relationship with popcorn.
Yeah.
Every time I go to the movie theater, I'm like, yeah, let's get popcorn. I'm like, why the fuck did I get popcorn? This
digging,
is the worst.
Just shells out of your.
It's like I'm
gums.
Bleeding from my gums.
Exactly. That's how I feel about Twizzlers.
Really?
Yeah.
But they just melt. It's sugar.
But you chew it. It gets in between your teeth, and you're like. You're in there with your, you know, trying to get it out.
I've never had that problem.
I'm a Snickers man.
Snickers man?
Chocolate.
Fun fact about Snickers.
Yeah.
I got all these fun facts.
They'll kill you.
Well, no. So a lot of people go out and buy, like, protein bars, like Clif bars and energy bars, stuff like that. Screw all that noise. Get a Snickers. Equally as much protein, just as much calories, and protein and all that good stuff, and fat.
Really?
Yeah. It is a honest and actually better substitute to Clif bars is just to eat a Snickers.
But I like Clif bars.
I like Clif bars too, but I'm just saying, if it's a price per performance comparison, Snickers wins.
What about calories, like sheer bulk of food? Yep. Same in Snickers, really?
I think the only thing that's different is there's more fiber.
Yeah.
In a Clif bar,
they fill you up more then.
But, you know, sort of, but it's fiber. Yeah. No? I mean, I believe this because my father, he was in the Navy, and one of their survival exercises, you know, the whole they drop you off in the wilderness and like pick you up a day later or like 2 days later. And the joke, he always said, they leave you with a Snickers, like some basic supplies and a Snickers. That's all they leave you with. And now after doing some research, it makes sense because there's a lot of like fat, calories, and protein in those.
Huh. Don't they melt, though, when it's hot out and stuff?
Oh, God, what a worry wart.
I know.
Just eat it.
I'm just trying to justify my Clif Bar. I love it in the morning, like when I go camping.
You're just a hipster. It's fine.
I like eating Clif Bars and coffee in the morning.
Clif Bars and coffee?
Yeah.
What, do you drive a Saab?
Yeah. I wish.
Subaru? You Subaru driver?
Yeah, I do drive. Actually,
yeah, nailed it.
Yeah, that's a big stretch, big guess, right?
Let me guess, you like Starbucks too?
I've been. I remember when Starbucks was invented,
man.
I was in Seattle at the time when it, you know,
to me,
Starbucks is like this little corner store that we used to be like, oh, wow, now part of Seattle's everywhere. It has taken over stuff, but
yeah.
Maybe you don't. you probably don't even remember what it was like before Starbucks.
Do you wear a North Face sweater? Yeah, I remember what it's like before Starbucks. You go to Pano's, you sit down, you put down a dollar, you get a cup of coffee, you
eat really
terrible
shitty coffee,
food.
Right?
Oh, it was terrible coffee, yeah. But it was free. It was limitless.
Yeah.
And then you smoke your cigarettes and you're like in high school, so you're having these deep, esoteric, philosophical right. conversations about really, really dumb stuff.
Yeah.
And you're there till like 3 a.m, then you go home and you're all stupid the next day at school, and that's coffee.
Nah, I like good coffee.
What, are you trying to say my memories are bad?
No, I'm saying your coffee sucks.
Okay.
Well,
okay.
Don't get me. You remember what I wrote about Avanti's coffee, right?
Right. Yeah. Avanti's coffee. That was terrible coffee, but I love that coffee.
Did you? I can't. Yeah. It gives me headaches if I drink more than like a cup or two, and I always do. I drink like six cups when I'm there.
Yeah. I don't like Starbucks coffee. I think I've actually. I feel like I'm from Boston now because I'm a big Dunkin' Donuts believer in their coffee.
Yeah, that's not bad.
I really like their coffee. I don't know what it is, but yeah.
It goes with donuts.
No, the thing is, like, I go to Dunkin' Donuts for the coffee, then I drive to Mighty Fine for the donuts. Is that weird?
That is weird.
But that's the way to do it.
You know, I'd say I've come to appreciate Tim Hortons.
Yeah, their bits are okay.
not for the donut. I actually like their coffee.
Oh, no, their coffee's terrible.
Really?
Oh, God.
What's better than
Dunkin' Donuts?
Yeah, there's hardly any places around there.
Where I work, there's a Dunkin' Donuts right across the street. So I have a Tim Hortons on one side and Dunkin' Donuts across the street.
And I
risk my life as Frogger would to go to Dunkin' Donuts across Peach Street.
That's hilarious.
Because it's like the only place to get it. But it's so much worth it. Like, and the prices are basically the same.
Right.
I don't know what it is. But I think it's just like Tim Hortons coffee always tastes stale.
Does it?
It tastes like it's been on the burner too long.
You know what coffee I hate is Panera coffee.
Yeah, theirs is real bad.
Yeah, plus they're evil.
Oh, really?
You don't know about Panera?
Lay it on me. Let's air all this dirty laundry.
Yeah. I don't know if I should.
I don't even want to talk about my week. I just want to hear.
They
about
have been accused of racist hiring practices.
Oh, naturally.
Yeah,
naturally.
And had been apparently successfully sued by someone, or they settled out of court or something.
Yeah, so successfully.
Yeah, well,
if they settled outside of court.
Well, it's hard. You know, legally, not right. I mean, if you settle, it doesn't. It just means that both parties.
Yeah,
want to avoid
but the public.
Court battle.
Yeah, but the public side's like.
Yeah, well, I think it's wrong to assume that. The person is admitting
you're
fault.
You're no fun. You are no fun.
I know. I just can't.
You're,
I
like,
just
trying to be, like, such the even keeler on this, and it's not fun.
I know.
It's much better when, like, we should do like, almost like a crossfire thing where you take a stance really hard, and I take a stance really hard, and we just yell at each other for about a half an hour.
You know, it's funny, because didn't we talk about this before? Like,
yeah, we did.
I thought it was, like, arguing with the Seawolves announcer guy,
right.
Greg Gagne. And I listened on the podcast, and I'm like, I'm the nicest guy. I'm like, like, how much of an aggressive asshole do you have to be to actually come across as sounding aggressive on a podcast?
I mean, go just turn on the TV, man. They're all on TV.
Yeah.
that's how they get the headlines.
I guess we could go there, but what do we argue about?
I don't know.
Tim Hortons coffee.
Yeah.
It sucks. It's great.
About popcorn and Twizzlers.
Yeah.
That's got the hard line.
Essentially, you agreed with me in that.
Yeah, I did.
You folded. I won that one.
God damn it. I didn't know it was a competition going on.
What's the score right now?
A lot to nothing so far.
I don't know. But so far, you've hit on everything I want to talk about. I think Halloween, the mm-hmm. World Series, which I just gave a shout out.
Yeah, baseball's over. Sad day.
The one thing I'll say about this World Series, I was actually surprised how much hate Boston's been getting over this.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it's new to me. Like, I grew up
they get it all the
with
time.
A loser team, and now everyone hates us. It's weird.
Mm-hmm. That's what happens.
Yeah. Success breeds enmity.
You want to try that one more time?
Enmity. I was going to say anonymity, but that's not true.
Anonymity. Onomatopoeia.
Yeah. What did you want to talk about? You want the elections? I doubt it. Come on.
Yeah, I didn't go. I checked out.
Yeah. What was it like? Have you ever voted?
Yeah, I voted. I vote all the time, except for this time. I'm actually really, 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 like, I don't know why I didn't do it. I just, like I said, I think I just got so caught up in what I was doing, I totally spaced it. This week, so we actually just got back from an interesting meeting. We went to Penn State Barron, because the project I mainly work on is an independent game development project where I talk to developers. And anyhow, I caught word of that out in Penn State Barron that they have a game.
Oh, you just heard about that?
Yeah, I just heard about it.
Oh, okay.
Well, I knew about it, but I didn't know how burgeoning it was or how far along it is. But they seem to have actually a quite nice program building. And I finally went and introduced myself to their club, their game design club.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really awesome just to see all these guys, because it's so funny because, you know, talking to them and the games that they're playing, I'm actually being able to talk to a lot of the people that are making the games that they're playing and enjoying.
Well, it seems like a natural partnership with your
And the funny thing was is there's this thing called a game jam. Are you familiar with what a game jam is?
Gotta hope it's not something you put on toast.
No, it is not something you put on toast. What it is, so video games take a lot of time to make. And so what has happened is there are these events called game jams, in which basically people get together and form small teams, and they make a game in the allotted time.
Okay.
The most recent one that was held was the zero-hour game jam. So I don't know if you guys know this, but daylight saving time just happened. And so there's a game jam that celebrates that time, that hour difference. So basically what happens is you make a game in an hour.
Oh, really?
And when the time zone switch is over, it's like the game, it's like you never lost any time.
Oh, that's funny.
So it was a game that was literally made in 0 hours.
Wow. That's cool.
And so what they do, and it's not like a huge event, but basically teams get together of programmers and artists, and they make a game. And whether it's sometimes it's weeks, sometimes it's a day, there's a 72-hour, there's a week-long, and all different sorts of varieties. But anyhow, talking to them, it kind of got my brain thinking, why doesn't Erie do one?
Yeah.
And so I might be looking into something like that here in the near future.
What do you think of the program? Oh, let me ask you a couple of questions about it. One, do you think, is this an effective way for kids to get involved in the gaming industry?
Oh, absolutely. The best way to get involved in the gaming industry is to start making games as soon as possible.
Right.
Because the education for game design is still a really, really new scene. Like, for the longest time, a lot of people who make games go to school for things like programming. But the thing is, in programming, you're learning how to make applications like Word and or like web scripts and things like that, like websites, web design, stuff like that.
Right.
You're not necessarily thinking about player interaction or game theory or these things that are a lot more of the intangibles that make up good games.
Yeah.
And so the fact now that we're having programs that are starting to dedicate themselves to teaching students how to effectively not only make a game, but then the tools necessary, like the real tools that you need to know, because certain languages that you'll use for making applications, you're not necessarily going to use for game design.
Right.
There's like actual technical differences between these two things. And so to specialize even further, is it only makes sense for a better scene. The only thing that is not quite there yet, and it's something that if any good educational system has, is when you start bringing professionals back. Because a lot of times a lot of people who are making games aren't necessarily teaching how they made games. They're just making more games, and then they retire, and then they go buy a yacht or go get into beer making or whatever.
Right.
Whereas if you look at a lot of other educational departments, a lot of the teachers that come back to teach have either worked in the field for so long, and they're bringing all that experience that they have from the field back into the classroom, and there's so much value there. And so that's where things like game jams and guest speakers and like that help out, because it allows people to kind of get an idea from other people and then to iterate really rapidly and to make something really quick.
But, you know, this question that is not for me. But wouldn't it be just better to go out and make a friggin' game than to go to a university program?
It is, but it's incredibly hard to just make a game.
Yeah.
It is. Making a game is so interdisciplinary that it's really, really difficult to make it by yourself. And then also on top of that, it's really, really hard not only to make a game, but then to get people to know about your game and then buy your game.
Right.
You're talking about marketing at that point. Right. Marketing is not necessarily the same as making games. Someone who is market savvy or marketing savvy is probably not going to be like engineer savvy.
Right. No, sure. I get that. But I guess part of me feels, you know, a lot of with the things that are involved with computer programming, I mean, a lot of the programs teach tools and not concepts.
Right.
Well,
absolutely. That's what is interesting about these game programs.
Yeah.
Because they're not only teaching tools, they're very much thinking about concepts.
Okay.
And I think I can't say go to school for game design.
Right.
I can say make games.
Right.
Like, and that's something that we all can believe in. And I'm with you on that level. Like, if you want to do something, go do something.
Yeah.
That's the best way to do anything.
Because there's a new multimedia major at Penn State Barron.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the classes are teaching the students how to use certain software tools. In my mind, like, you know, if you want a good blog, you have to be a good writer. And
right.
The tool's easy to learn, right? And I suspect that's true with a lot of other aspects, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the university is now moving away towards a solid curriculum of humanities and you know, hard sciences, and towards these, I guess, what they consider work applicable classes that teach people, you know, how to jump right into the marketplace. And I feel
they're creating social media experts.
Right. Yeah.
We know how we feel about social media experts on here.
How do we feel about social?
Not good.
You don't feel good about them?
Oh, the thing is, they're very important.
Yeah.
They are very important, but finding good ones is really hard. a lot of people like to say they're social media experts, but really they just use Twitter.
Right.
A really good social media expert not only knows how to use all these things, but they know how to use them in a way that's not egregious and actually works. And the thing is, you can't teach that. That's just knowing your audience and knowing how to attract your audience and knowing networking. And that's something you can't teach it in the classroom, but you can teach it in practice. Like all the skills that I have learned when it comes to networking and like working rooms and stuff like that has come from hanging out and talking to my friends that do that type of stuff and then getting the mindset of what the goals are for those things. Because just like anything else, there's goals. You know what I mean? You have a certain like end result that you want to succeed when you walk into a room full of individuals that you want to like pick your brains or you want to pitch an idea to.
Right.
And the best way of doing that is just getting through it. Because, you know, a lot of it's just big talk. You know, and posturing. I hate posturing. That's literally like my – I hate it. It's the worst thing
ever.
You're
like schlumping into a room.
Well, no. I mean, it's just – yeah, nailed it. But I think you know what I mean. About there's like always a certain level of people who are like posturing. Oh, this is what I could do for you.
Yeah,
I hate that.
There's a fine line, right,
mm-hmm.
between being a good salesperson and being too good of a salesperson.
Right. It's
sure.
It's a difference between like a used car salesman and,
right.
I don't know, someone you like.
Some of my best friends were used. No, I know some great used car salesmen.
That's
who are
so,
like,
so do
don't give you bullshit, right?
Right.
It's like, this is the car, this is what's wrong with it.
But those are rare,
much,
right? Those are rare to find. But when you find them, you go back to them.
Right, exactly.
Because they understand how to give proper customer service.
Right.
It's just like, you know, baristas at Starbucks.
Right.
Some of them are awesome. Other of them, you're like, oh, this is a job for you. This is just your part-time job while you're in college. Got it.
But going back to the original point, I feel like college should teach kids how to think.
Oh, man, you're so crazy.
I know. How to think, and then the tools and all that will follow, right?
Yes,
I mean,
I agree.
Halfway until, like me, has learned how to use these tools. You know, I've learned how to use blog tools. I've learned how to use online tools. I've learned on the job. Someone mm-hmm. gives me a tool and says, you have to do this with this tool. Figure it out. You crack open the manual. You do it. Boom. It's done, right?
Yep. I agree. I think the most important thing from school is not necessarily deadlines.
So is this program teaching the tools? You're saying it's teaching the concepts?
I don't know. This is my first interaction with them. And so far, it seems like the professor that is in charge has very much a mindset for making sure that they know not only the tools, but also to network and those things.
Right.
So some of the things I brought up, he was like, I'm so happy you brought this up because I tell all these engineers in this room that they need to start networking and how important it is to have like a human interaction with people.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
they don't believe me.
They should have a class for engineers in that.
Yeah.
How to talk.
How do,
girl,
speak?
Right?
How do I speak?
that's the seminar.
Right. But, I mean, it's, you know, and they seem to be setting up like trips to GDC. GDC is the Global Developers Conference, which is like the biggest event held out in San Francisco for game developers to go to. And so it seems very much minded in the fact that not only is it teaching them how to make a game, but why they're making a game, and then like how to network and connect and find openings and things like that. Which is that's.
Have you ever taken any gaming classes or anything like that?
Nope.
Do you program at all? I mean, what's the end goal here?
What's my end goal?
Yeah.
Culture change.
All right. Through gaming?
Yeah, absolutely. I look at video games, and you might not know this yet. You might not have seen these yet.
Yeah.
But video games are the next medium, the next artistic medium in which we can actually have real expression and interaction. The greatest thing about video games is that you can interact them with on a much more intimate level than you can with film, than you can with painting, than you can with anything else. And the coolest thing about it, and this is much like I take this note from Roger Ebert.
Yeah.
When he first started trying to do his stuff with film, film was not taken very seriously. And he'd said, you know, damn it all to hell. If film's going to be taken seriously, we need to start taking it seriously. And I'm going to hold film at a certain standard and make people care. And I envision that in the same way with video games. Video games won't ever become seriously until we start taking them seriously.
Right.
And the coolest thing is now, not necessarily the Call of Duty, is like those things are... Those are the Michael Bays of video games. But however, there is a large section of video games in which there is real artistic expression happening. And we need to champion those.
It's funny you mentioned Roger Ebert because he's the dude that said
they can't be.
Right.
Which is hilarious because
can't be art.
Which is so – I find it very ironic because people said that to him about film. And so it's kind of hilarious it came so full circle where he was, you know, basically condemning a whole burgeoning art form when he spent most of his life defending another art form.
Right.
You know, that's some level of irony there.
Do you remember what its basis was? It was like, it can't be art because it's not an expression of an individual or something like that?
But neither are films.
Well, the participatory nature takes out the receiving of the message, right? When you're participating in the form, right, the according to Ebert, that's
right. That's a bastardization. Unfortunately, I disagree because that's when we get something called emergence, right? Now, or immersion, both these things. So immersion is something that people strive for in art. Mm-hmm. They want someone to really just fall into their pieces, right? And if you look at a painting, they want you to feel like you're in that painting, or in a film, similar things like that. With video games, that's actually possible. And then also there's emergent narratives or emergent stories. And what I mean by that is when things are happening, not only are you participating, but you are integral to that whole experience.
Right. By the way, I should mention I disagree with Ebert. I'm just
absolutely. I can and that's important. It's good to spar. Yeah. You know what I mean? I like this. I always like sparring with people because I think it's one. It helps an individual kind of help solidify their argument, and also it's good to keep your mental knives sharp, as you were.
Right.
But the other thing I think I like what I enjoy most about video games, and not necessarily, I'm not saying all video games do this, but there are a lot out there, and if you search, they're very easy to find.
Right.
I look at art, because I went to art school, art is a form of communication. This is how I've defined it. Now, art is more things than just communication, but on a very primitive level, you're communicating ideas through whatever medium you want to. It's another form of just communication. And the great thing about video games is that they're extremely communicative. Not only through visuals, not only through audio, not only through the story that's happening on the screen, what the characters are saying to each other, but you're also directly engaging with that communication because you have a control stick in your hand.
Right.
And though, so there's so many different levels in which there's a conversation happening subliminally, like you don't even have to think about it. You're just doing it. That's incredibly powerful. Yeah. And I still don't. And we are just scraping the surface of how deep that level of like interaction can go.
Right. No, it's true. I agree with you. I mean, I think Roger Ebert was I'm trying to combine his name. Ebert was hung up on the experiential aspect of video games and didn't think that was an art form, but obviously, right, a lot of contemporary artists are into, setting up installations in which people come in and interact with us, you know, and have an experience.
Right.
That, you know, displaces them from their everyday lives, which computer games definitely can do.
Right.
I'm not on the fence. I recognize they can be an art form, and I think we both agree here they far from it, right? I mean, most of it's, you know, if anything, like, fantastical expressions of adolescent male fantasy, right?
A lot of misogyny. Right. Like, I don't mean to mince words. Like, a lot of what is popularized,
right,
is causing those who are in there that are actually trying to make a difference. They have a lot to overcome, just because the industry is so full of so many tropes. I mean, you think TV and film's bad,
yeah.
I mean, video games originally is just like the bastard child of all of that misogyny that basically TV tropes and stuff like that just carried even further. But now, small young males, or you get to engage in these power fantasies.
Yeah.
And the coolest thing is, though, is in the independent game space, that's changing rapidly.
Sure, yeah. No, I've heard.
The last game I played is this game called Gone Home, in which you play as a girl. You come back home from after a trip to Europe, and you're looking to find your sister when you get home, but your parents are gone, your sister is gone as well. And so you're looking through her, and through the story, you find out that your younger sister realizes that she's a lesbian. And she goes through that. And she's also trying to figure out, you know, her own identity and friends and where she fits in high school.
Yeah.
And it's this extremely powerful and transformative experience that who knew that something like that could even exist in this space.
Right.
But then all of a sudden, there it is.
I've poked around at some independent games myself and stuff, but I've yet to find an experience in a computer game that even comes remotely close to like reading a good book.
Or seeing a good movie. You got to come over some weekend.
All right,
I'll put you through the paces because I have a stack of them.
The things that you know, it seems like they're hitting these like primal buttons of like, you know, get a reward for doing an action and also like pumping you full of endorphins. Like to me, video games are really good at that. And I just like the storylines I've read are so
bad.
Yeah. You know?
Even
the ones that are trying to be artistic,
really good are really bad.
It's really bad, you know? And it's tough. It's tough to find.
Yeah.
I'm yet to be convinced. I understand the potential, like it's.
Oh,
but I've yet to see it anywhere close to execution.
Yeah, and like
if
I
you've
said,
got some. To show,
I got.
That's
I got.
Cool.
There is.
We should do a podcast.
Yeah, we could. Woo-hoo. Very, very easily.
Yeah.
That's what I deal with. That when the main show that I do is I sit down and I do 1 hour conversations with people who make games and I ask them how and why. And the great thing is you get to hear, And it's not just the big bloody, you know, Assassin's Creed, Call of Duty, Madden games. We're talking
which
much,
we love.
Anyways. Yeah, yeah. I still play Call of Duty. Yeah. I still play Grand Theft Auto and all those things. I'm still excited.
I love endorphins. Yeah, I love little pellets for my actions.
You know, I like Michael Bay films. You know, I'm not afraid to say it. Like, I think they're bad, but I enjoy them. They're great blockbuster movies, you know, and I respect them from what they are. But I also really like things, you know, like Drive, you know, or Blue Valentine, those films that are really brutal to watch.
Right.
So the same thing is true for video games.
Yes. Okay. I can live with that. Yeah. And I want to see some of these, man.
Oh, there's I got oodles. Stacks on stacks on stacks on stacks.
Let's be best friends. I can raid your video game collection.
Do you want to introduce the interview?
Yes, Edith Witter, oceanographer, marine biologist, deep ocean explorer. You heard the interview, right?
Yeah, I just started listening to it. It sounds great.
Yeah, it's I love the technology we have to tape this thing.
Yeah,
The possibilities are limitless now. We can probably talk to anyone we want.
Who should we call? Just get a number and start calling people. Should we do like they do on like the morning show where they call random people in the morning to see if they're awake?
Hilarious.
You awake?
You know, I was trying to see if Howard Dean would do it. Maybe because I talked to him and Bill Kristol for the Global Summit thing that's coming up, but which Edith Witter is a part of, by the way. She's I wish I had my little schedule here. I think she's going on the Thursday of the Global Summit, the Global Summit week, and she's definitely worth hearing. She's I don't know. She's been to the bottom of the ocean, you know, like a number of times. She's the first person to catch like giant squid on tape.
It's
like,
no big deal.
Yeah. She's kick-ass and cool, and she does these amazing things, and she has this very strong environmental message to us from the bottom of the ocean. That's
awesome.
Definitely worth listening to. But yeah, I mean, I was thinking maybe if we could get Dean on tape, that would be cool. Maybe I'll try to sweet talk him.
Mm-hmm. Sounds exciting.
Yeah. He's you're a pragmatic progressive like me, I think. I suspect you have similar feelings about him that I do. So
yeah.
And it's interesting writing something like that, trying not to get all that bias and stuff in your piece. You know, I tried to treat Howard Howard Dean and Bill Kristol fairly. And
right.
Did you read that? Probably not.
No, I haven't read that one yet.
Yeah. Asshole.
Whoa. That was harsh.
Yeah.
You know, when was the last episode you listened to one of my shows?
I don't even know if I can know your podcast name. See, isn't that terrible?
And
Big Sushi? Big Sushi.
Yeah, nailed it.
Woo-hoo!
And I'm the asshole.
I never said I wasn't.
That's true.
Yeah.
I never said I wasn't either. So, hey,
woo-hoo!
Right back at you. Two assholes.
Two assholes.
This is the Eerie Listener Two Asshole Show.
Two assholes in a cup. boy, I think we should end it there. Okay. I'm here with Edith Witter, Dr. Edith Witter, oceanographer, marine biologist, and underwater explorer. But Dr. Witter, how are you doing, by the way?
Very well, Jay. How are you?
Great. Thank you. Before I get into the underwater stuff, which I'm totally fascinated with, I just want to mention you're a fellow Jumbo. I went to Tufts University as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. How'd you like your experience there?
Oh, very much. It was it's a beautiful campus, and I had some amazing experiences that helped lead to my becoming a marine biologist.
That was before Davis Square was built up, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I was there right around the time Davis Square was built up, but sort of before they started putting all those cool buildings on campus. So.
I actually haven't been back for a long time.
Yeah, neither have I. I don't know why. I guess the parking was so hard. I keep, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
There is that.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, Dr. Witter. Real quick, the first thing I want to talk about is that you're a deep sea diver. You explore the ocean depths. Is that right? I mean, how do you go about doing that?
I've been using submersibles for decades now, and the submersibles I use are generally midwater submersibles. They're good to a depth of between 2,000 and 3,000 feet.
Okay. And what kind of place, where do you go? I mean, I assume there's big canyons or trenches in the ocean that you explore, but give us an idea about how far down or whereabouts you go.
Well, I've been all along the eastern coast of the United States, over to the Mediterranean, done some dives along the west coast, the Monterey Canyon, off of Monterey, California, down to Costa Rica. I've been trying for years to get down to Australia, but still haven't succeeded there. But
Yeah.
Got over to Japan last year.
It sounds so fascinating. I mean, when you say submersible, you're talking about these little tiny submarines, right?
That's right. Usually one person to three person, four person at most.
And when you go on a dive, how long are you beneath the surface?
Well, the dives we were making last year off Japan were as long as 8 hours, but I think more often they're about 3 to 4 hours.
And how much room do you have down there? I mean, what are we talking about?
Like for me, it feels pretty roomy. I'm 5'2", so submersibles have never seemed all that crowded to me, but it can feel pretty claustrophobic to some people.
Sure. And you, I don't know, I find this utterly fascinating. When you're down below in the bottom of the ocean or near it, do you have the lights off inside? I mean, are you sort of just floating around in the dark? Explain the sensation.
Well, there's a whole bunch of sensations.
Yeah.
Because it's a completely different experience. So a submersible, when it passes through the air-water interface, you know, you notice immediately things change a lot,
okay.
And especially the colors of light. Seawater acts like a filter, and it filters out the reds and the yellows and the oranges, and it's that beautiful blue-green color in the surface waters. And then as you travel down deeper, it becomes more of an indigo blue, and then it becomes just a gray. And in fact, at that point, all you can see about down around 2,000 feet, if you look straight overhead, you can just see a gray light above you.
Okay.
And if you, 3,000 feet is probably the absolute limit for any known creature to be able to see downwelling sunlight in the ocean. And then below that depth, the only light available is bioluminescence.
Okay. And, so when you're in the submersible, does it like how well can you see? Do you use cameras to see outside, or are there portholes? I mean, is it natural light, or are you just looking through monitors and that kind of thing?
No, I've been very fortunate. Most of the submersibles I've been in have a big plexiglass sphere that you're sitting in,
uh-huh.
And so you have a fabulous field of view. And one of the glorious things about being down there and seeing the bioluminescence is that the human eye is really, really sensitive. It's very hard to get cameras that can see as clearly as the human eye does.
Oh,
and so I feel very privileged to have seen the things that I have seen, because it's just, I can share it to some extent with cameras, but not nearly the experience that I get in person.
Oh, wow. That sounds totally amazing. I want to do it. So how much training do you have to do to be able to go in one of these things?
For the ones where I piloted, it took some weeks of training to be the pilot. But, you know, a lot of these are 2- and 3-person submersibles that have a pilot already with them. And then you need no training at all. You just hop in. And there's no decompression or anything, so it's actually in many ways safer than scuba diving.
Oh, that's interesting. So is the cabin pressurized? I mean, is that how you keep
yes.
the – okay. Wow, that's fine. And I also noticed that you have done deep-sea underwater diving suits. Is that correct, besides the submersibles?
Yeah, the first one I did was actually the diving suit Wasp, which was developed for use by the offshore oil industry for working on oil rigs.
Okay.
And it could go down to 2,000 feet in the ocean. And it's a weird thing. It's kind of like crawling into a martini shaker with a bubble head and Michelin Man arms.
That's funny.
And then thrusters that you control with foot switches that allow you to fly the suit around.
And how deep do those go?
2,000 feet.
Wow, so that's almost as deep as a submersible.
Yeah.
What's the advantage to doing that? Are you able to get around more or manipulate objects or something better? Is there an advantage to it?
The offshore oil industry developed them to be able to have divers go deeper to work on oil heads on the oil rigs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're still very cumbersome to operate. And I think there are advantages now with some of the smaller submersibles. The suit is tethered, so it's connected to the surface through an umbilical that carries the power and the communications.
Okay.
And that tether becomes quite a nuisance if you're working in high currents and it can get tangled. And
I was going to say that sounds kind of scary to have your life tether running 2,000 feet to the surface.
Yeah.
So I guess obviously you study life beneath the ocean or surface. So, but the ocean's pretty big, right? I mean, when you go down, how much life do you see as you descend through the layers? Are you aiming for particular spots that are rich in undersea life, or how's that work?
Well, you're likely to see more life if you're in the coastal zone environment.
Right.
You know, there are regions offshore that are pretty sparse, but you're still going to see stuff. You just have to be patient in order to see it.
Right.
Also, I've had a suspicion for a long time that we don't see as much as we might because our submersibles are so bright and noisy that they're scaring a lot of these animals away.
Right.
Using white light doesn't make a lot of sense because, you know, these animals are adapted to see the dimmest of light, and they don't even have eyelids or any way to protect their eyes from the bright light. The only way to protect themselves is to avoid the bright light. So the noisy thrusters, they actually scream on hydraulic systems. So I've been saying that we need to be more stealthful when we're exploring the deep sea. And in fact, every chance I've gotten to test that hypothesis, it's proved out. Mm-hmm. So one of the early camera systems I developed was called the Eye in the Sea, which is uses red light that's invisible to these animals that are adapted to see primarily blue light.
Okay.
And it's tricky to use red light because, as I said, seawater acts as a filter, and it filters out the red light. So it's hard to illuminate with red light, so you have to use super sensitive cameras to compensate for it. But the other thing is that usually when people put cameras down in the ocean, they put bait down to attract predators to the bait. But all they're going to do with that is attract scavengers.
Okay.
And I wanted to be able to attract active predators. And so I used a lure that imitated a certain type of bioluminescent display that I thought might be attractive to large predators. And the very first time we tested it was on a expedition in the Gulf of Mexico. And 86 seconds after I turned that lure on for the first time, we recorded a squid over 6 feet long that was completely new to science.
Wow. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. You got on camera one of the first sightings of a giant squid in its natural environment, right? Using these bioluminescent lures.
Yeah, to me the Gulf of Mexico thing was even more exciting because it was a completely new species. But yeah, I mean the giant squid was awesome too. That was last year, and we used the same optical lure and got the first images ever recorded of a giant squid. But that kind of gives you a hint of just how poorly we've been exploring the deep sea when you think about the fact that we've known about giant squid for, well over a century because they happen to float when they die.
Right.
And so we've had carcasses to examine. And we knew they were down there in large numbers based on the number of giant squid beaks found in the bellies of whales, sperm whales. The fact that we'd never seen one, I think, is a clear indication that we've been doing it wrong. Because as soon as we went down with using red light and an optical lure, on my second deployment, we got the first images ever recorded.
Let me go back to the new species of squid real quick. How did you spot it was a new species right away? I mean, I assume they're swimming around the submersible.
This was actually swimming around the camera system that we left on the bottom.
Oh, I see.
And none of us on board the ship could identify the squid. We looked at it, and it wasn't anything any of us recognized. Mm-hmm. So I sent the video to experts at the Smithsonian who examined it, and they were the ones that declared it couldn't even be placed in any known scientific family.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. Did you get to name it?
No, you don't actually get to name them unless you can have a specimen in hand.
Oh, that's too
so
bad.
video's not enough. Although nowadays you can have, instead of having an actual specimen in hand, you can do DNA.
Right.
And so I had a graduate student for a while working on a little harpoon that might be able to grab a little bit of flesh of one of these animals. But so far that hasn't panned out.
Is this common? Do you typically discover new species on your dives? I mean, it seems like, you know, in the old days in the 1800s, people got all sorts of chances to name species, but it seems much rarer nowadays.
Actually, on any dive, I am not at all surprised to at least see a new behavior, if not an actual new species. Mm-hmm. But anytime, you know, you go to an area that hasn't been explored before, there's very high probability of discovering new species.
Wow, that's really cool. And, I should mention, too, that you started a nonprofit association called the ORCA. Excuse me, its acronym is ORCA, but it's Ocean Research and Conservation Association. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that and what the mission of that organization is?
Yeah, I started ORCA in 2005, and that was the year after we discovered that new squid. Mm-hmm. But it was also right that year that the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy report came out, the same year that we discovered the squid. And that was detailing the deterioration of the oceans, and it was pretty much of a call of alarm. And I felt like we're destroying the ocean before I'm even getting a chance to find out what's in it. And so I wanted to see what I could do to help. So I developed the ORCA with the idea that we're trying to find technological solutions to ocean conservation challenges. And an awful lot of the pollution that's ending up in the ocean actually is showing up in even deep sea squid, believe it or not.
Wow. Okay.
And so the point is to try to track the pollution coming off the land and get it stopped at its source. And so we've been developing sensors and techniques that allow us to do that and make pollution visible so that we can do something about getting it stopped.
Here in Lake Erie, for example, I recently wrote a story about microplastics in the lake. And that's they found the highest concentration on Earth in Lake Erie, of course, right? But I imagine that's a problem. And one of the problems in Lake Erie, scientists suspect, is that the bits of plastic are sinking to the bottom of the lake bed and becoming involved in the food chain, being consumed by benthic organisms. So is that something that you're working as well? Is that a concern too? I assume the ocean floor is where a lot of that stuff would end up.
Yeah, we're very concerned about the range of pollutants that we're putting into our ecosystems and how they're impacting the animals. Mm-hmm. And so when you start looking at the numbers of pollutants and things like microplastics that are ending up in the ocean, the idea of trying to develop sensors for each one of those becomes overwhelming.
Right.
And so what we ended up doing is we've developed kind of a canary in the coal mine approach. You know, coal miners used to take canaries down with them.
Sure.
As a assay for the poisonous gases they had to worry about. And so that's what's known as a broad spectrum bioassay. It's sensitive to a bunch of stuff and it's a living test. And so the broad spectrum bioassay that we use is bioluminescent bacteria.
Okay.
So if a lot of pollution ends up residing in the sediments, you know, in the bottom of Lake Erie,
right,
and the bottom of our local estuary, you take a sediment sample. That's where most of the pollution is. But now how do you figure out how toxic it is? Well, we mix a little of that bioluminescent bacteria with the sediment and see how much the light goes out.
Oh, I see. That's interesting.
Because the light output of the bacteria is linked to their respiratory chain, basically their breathing. So then anything that interferes with that interferes with the light output. So you've got this quick, inexpensive test for saying, okay, this spot is way more toxic than this spot over here. It doesn't tell us what the toxin is, mm-hmm, but it allows us to create the pollution gradient maps and figure out where the hot spots are.
Right.
Then we can take a sample of the hot spot and send that off for more detailed analysis. It saves tremendous amounts of time and money.
And your expertise, of course, is in bioluminescence, that's right?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that. How does a creature produce light? It seems mind-boggling.
Yeah, people are most familiar with fireflies, mm-hmm, and you know there are some other land animals that make light, but in the ocean it's everywhere, and so it's a chemical reaction, just like when you break a light stick, you're mixing chemicals together. That's called a chemiluminescent reaction, and bioluminescence is just one form of chemiluminescence. It's not as it's frequently called phosphorescence.
Okay.
That's a misnomer. Phosphorescence is light, excited by light. So you shine a light on a glow-in-the-dark T-shirt or a toy, and then it glows for a while afterwards. That's phosphorescence.
Right.
This is from an actual chemical reaction. So animals produce chemicals in their bodies, or they eat things that are essential to producing the light reaction. And then they control the light output often by their nervous systems, so they can create a flash of light. And then they use it for everything, for finding food, for attracting mates, for protecting against predators.
Mm-hmm. And when you're down underneath in your submersible, you must see these all around the submersible. Is that right? Do you sometimes land in a big patch of animals all lit up?
Oh, yes. I mean, that's what needs to be on your bucket list.
Yeah.
My favorite place in the world is 3,000 feet down, about to return from a dive. We turn all the lights off and then come up through the water column, just watching this fireworks display. Wow. All around the submersible. And it changes as you go through different depths, because you're seeing different types of flashes from different types of organisms. And you'll see an explosion of what looks like blue smoke from something that's spewing out its luminescence as a way to temporarily blind a predator, and a spray of blue sparks. You'll see a long, long chain of what is actually a jellyfish called siphonophores, and it'll drape itself over the upper work structure of the submersible, glowing and then kind of turning into this great flapping luminescent trail. It's just spectacular.
Wow, it sounds so cool. It just last year we had at the Global Summit, we had Dr. Kirshner. Do you know him, Robert Kirshner? I think he even suggested you as a speaker for this summit.
Remind me what his
he's an astrophysicist at Harvard.
He was okay.
He was involved in the Nobel project that discovered that the universe is expanding quicker. And, you know, talking to him was so, you know, so amazing. He was describing these theories of the universe and stuff. And I was so excited to see your name on the list and what you did, because it seems sort of the inverse of what Dr. Kirshner is studying, right? Instead of looking out into the heavens, we're focused down at the very depths, the hidden parts of the Earth that are still left to us.
Right. I study the stars below.
Yeah, exactly. And it sounds almost like a mirror image of the sky above. Is that accurate?
Oh, I think it's much more interesting.
Of course, right? That's cool. So talk to me about the importance of the ocean depths. You know, why do we need to study it? What's going on down there? And is there unlocked potential there that we can learn a lot from and use?
Absolutely. I mean, the ocean, we are an ocean planet. And, you know, 71% of the surface of our Earth is covered by water, but that's just surface area. If you think in terms of the living space on the planet, what's known as the biosphere, then the oceans represent more than 99% of our living space. So I think it's pretty darn important that we know what's going on in terms of that ecosystem, and not continue to just blindly destroy it with no understanding of how it's contributing to the basic life support system of our little spaceship here. And so we're doing things like, we're fishing out the oceans, just completely fishing out the oceans.
Right.
There's almost nothing left out there. The numbers are staggering. And at the same time, we're not just pulling these fish out of the midwater environment. We're dragging these net systems across the bottom of the ocean. And I've seen the before and after, and you'll have this beautiful underwater garden that's just the most exquisite thing you can ever imagine, that took thousands of years to develop and has life support for an incredible array of animals. And this net comes through for one haul of shrimp, and it's decimated and won't support life again for hundreds and maybe thousands of years. And it's completely unsustainable. It's going on all the time, and people are unaware of it, and it has to stop. At the same time, we're just filling up our oceans with pollutants. As I said, they're even showing up in the bodies of deep sea squid. So there's no place on Earth that's safe from the pollution that we're creating. And clearly we need to be a lot more aware of this incredible life support system that sustains us all on this planet. We really are a little spaceship hurtling through space. And, you know, if you think about you're on a 100,000 year voyage in a spaceship, you better be protecting your life support systems with everything you've got. Well, we're not doing that, and the consequences could be dire.
So, let's talk about that for a second. The ocean, besides providing food, right, which is part of the problem, it also supplies oxygen, right? It turns carbon dioxide into oxygen and it essentially provides a food chain for life on the planet. Is that right?
Correct. I mean, the oceans provide, our stable weather system. They definitely provide at least every other breath of oxygen you take. You should be thanking the oceans. They sustain a tremendous amount of life through the food that they produce, and they could produce so much more if we would just fish them sustainably instead of greedily.
Right. And also when we take out these fish species, you're impacting the whole food chain, the animals and plants that interrelate with those species as well.
Absolutely. That, and as I said, we know so little about these food webs and, the impact on them. So, things like fishing for some of the deep sea fish, like orange roughy, that were basically fished out before we knew enough to realize that, they don't reproduce until they're in their 20s.
Right. Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, and there were just a huge, huge number of these fish, and now they've been pretty much wiped out.
Right. I have another question for you. Hang on a sec. I can edit this part out. But I guess I just wanted to emphasize the holistic nature of the ocean. But what about climate change? I was going to ask you about climate change. What effect is climate change having on these deep sea environments?
Well, I mean, one of the things that's of great concern with climate change is how it may be eventually impacting ocean circulation patterns. So we have these great rivers running through the ocean, like the Gulf Stream. And as we see changes in the temperature, there's a real risk that it could impact these flow patterns that are a natural part of maintaining our stable weather system.
Mm-hmm.
And there's evidence that before we had that kind of flow system, that we didn't have agriculture. Agriculture depends on a stable weather system. And if we so disturb the planetary cycle that we impact the thermohaline circulation pattern, which is what this is called,
right,
then the consequences for us could be just devastating. The fact that we're resisting the idea of doing the things that could be protecting our oceans and our lives for financial reasons is pretty short-sighted.
Okay. And, of course, people can find more information about your efforts at Orca on the website. Is that correct?
Yes, if you go to teamorca.org, you can actually see the live data that we're bringing in from the sensor technology that we've developed called Kilroy. We call them Kilroy because we want them to be everywhere.
Right, right.
So it's a water quality monitoring device. And right now we have an array of them in the Indian River Lagoon, which was once called the most biologically diverse estuary along the in the United States. It's mm-hmm. along the east coast of Florida.
Okay.
And it's an estuary in terrible distress right now. We've had mass mortalities of dolphins, manatees, and pelicans, wipeout of seagrass. And it's just horrendous to see what's been happening there. And there's different problems in different parts of the lagoon, but we believe that with the monitoring that we've started to introduce, we can start to pin down some of these problems and figure out what we can do to get them stopped.
Huh, that's interesting. And I was just thinking, too, when you mentioned the manatees and the dolphins, I know in environmentalism, a lot of those species are, you know, the charismatic megafauna, right? The attractive, cute animals that we often use to point out, I guess, environmental distress for entire ecosystems, you know, like the grizzly bear, the panda, things like that.
Right.
But of course, right, the things that are going on, even at the microbiological level, are just as important, if not more important. In Lake Erie, for example, a lot of the agricultural runoff creates the harmful bacteria, the red tides and things like that. I assume that's a concern too with the estuaries and the other coastal regions of the world.
Absolutely. I mean, we've had very severe. Is that coming from you or from me?
I think it's from you. Maybe. Yeah. I don't think I'm getting anything. Could be. You hearing the little beeps? Are this what you're talking about?
No, I heard an advertisement.
No, that's not for me. That's funny. It did not get on the recording, so if it did, okay. I will excise it immediately.
Okay.
What was it advertising? I'm curious now.
Something about mucus.
That's got to be your phone.
Okay. What was I saying?
We were talking about the microbiological level of and the dangers of agricultural runoff and phosphates and things like that to the oceans.
Yeah, I had something I was going to say, but I've lost it. Nope, not coming back either.
It's lost in the depths.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for talking again, Dr. Witter. And is there anything else you'd like to add? Any other? I know. I wish we had a ton more listeners. We have a few hundred, but you know, obviously, water quality issues and pollution is you know, something we pay attention to here with the in the regard to the lakes.
I know what it was. Yeah, you were talking about the harmful algal blooms.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And we've been seeing some of those in the Indian River Lagoon, and that, you know, that a lot of that comes from nutrient runoff.
Right.
And so one of the things we're doing with the Kilroys is being able to figure out where those nutrients are coming from in order to try to get them stopped. But, you know, we've also got things like dolphins showing up with this flesh-eating fungal infection.
Okay.
And it just looks horrible. It looks like a cauliflower fungus all over their skin. And if you know anything about dolphins, you know they have exquisitely sensitive skin.
Wow.
They must be in agony with this fungal infection.
That
one's probably due to methylmercury ending up in their food chain.
Mm-hmm.
So these you know, charismatic megafauna, as you call them, are sentinels that are, you know, showing us the dangers in our local ecosystems. And, you know, that particular flesh eating fungal infection actually humans get in third world countries. And lately I've been feeling like I'm almost living in a third world country with some of the pollution problems we've been seeing.
Right. What are some sources? Do you know of any things that we can do to help stop the pollution or help at least curb it?
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, obviously there are, different problems in different areas, and that's one of the things is that there's a lot of finger pointing that goes on, and it's really important that we figure out what the sources are. So we've been seeing very large pulses of nitrogen coming out of the canal systems, and now we're trying to track it back to figure out, you know, is it coming from agriculture? Is it coming from people's lawns? Is it coming from golf courses? We're going to be able to pin it to an actual source, and it's probably different in different areas. There's other places where septic tanks can be a problem, but, we need to have the actual answers before we start throwing money at these problems because we have limited resources. And so we want to prioritize so that we do, you know, 80% that makes the biggest difference, or do the 20% effort that makes the 80% result.
Right, that makes sense, yeah.
And so that's what we're trying to do in each spot along the lagoon and any place else that we can install these is find out where the key problems are and take care of that 20% first with the limited dollars available.
Right. Yeah, I guess I'll wrap it up unless you have anything else to add about the ocean health and things that we should watch out for.
I think that's it.
Thank you so much for talking with me today. You'll be speaking Thursday, November 14th at the Jefferson Educational Society at 7:30, and I'll definitely be there. So I appreciate
Are you still
the
there?
Time. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, you just dropped out for a minute.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing you then. And thanks so much. I know Erie is far away from oceans, and I think the deepest part of our lake is in Erie. Of course, it's like a saucer. It's so shallow. I think the deepest is 100 feet. So it's probably not worth exploring. Although there's a lot of cool shipwrecks here. But
oh yeah, I bet there are.
Yeah, and I guess the shipwrecks preserve better in freshwater than saltwater. Is that right? Do you know anything about that, or do you get to go look at shipwrecks?
I haven't done much of that kind of thing. When we were diving in the Mediterranean, I was always hoping I was going to see one, but I never did.
That would be cool to see an old galleon or like a Phoenician
merchant
ship.
Yeah.
Oh, I had one more question for you.
Yes.
Submarine movies. What's your favorite submarine movie?
Probably The Abyss. They got kind of silly in parts of it, but still, that was a pretty cool one.
Yeah. Wasn't Steve Zissou, the Wes Anderson movie. Did you ever see that one?
No.
Okay. I'll have to find the exact name and maybe a link to it for you when you get here. So, all right. Thank you so much, Dr. Witter. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's good talking to you, Jay.
Yep. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
God, the green grass has finally grown to a solid elephant. When you're climbing over all the wire, we'll rip off your dress. The cat caught a cat's butt, who lied naked in the grass. They'll take you in your night fear, and we'll wake up and sky turns black.
Let me go.